This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovec. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Well, we just talked about Netflix coming out with its tiers in terms of its ad-supported streaming service.
T-I-E-R-S. Not tiers like earlier this year for Netflix.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Like those tiers?
Yeah, I mean, that was happening earlier this year.
I know. People were like, what?
Yeah, what's going on?
Ads? Netflix? Okay. So we mentioned that's going to launch that ad-supported plan on November 3rd. That story was reported by our Lucas Shaw, as is a most read on the Bloomberg that is in the new issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. And that story about Netflix's coming makeover in the face of some real streaming competition.
Yeah, the piece by Lucas Shaw, entertainment reporter for Bloomberg News. He joins us on the phone from Los Angeles. Give him a follow on Twitter at Lucas_Shaw and then sign up for Screen Time, his fantastic newsletter. Lucas, good to have you with us this afternoon. I want to go back years ago to sort of the DNA of Netflix, the way that it disrupted Blockbuster, but then kind of had to disrupt itself when it really brought streaming to the masses. Because I think that's a big part of your piece, because Netflix, once again, in order to succeed in this new ecosystem, has to disrupt itself one more time. Where should we start?
I mean, you can start with advertising, which is where we started earlier, because it's something Netflix has always said it would never do. You know,
never say never.
Being an ad-free streaming service was sort of a core part of its proposition, something that made it better than cable TV, where people were overwhelmed with 10, 15 minutes of advertising per hour, and is really a sign of kind of the, maybe not desperation, but the, you know, the challenge they face here, where they've just hit a wall in terms of growth over the last 18 months and are now doing two things, both advertising and charging for password sharing that they long said were not an issue. The one quibble I take with the comparison to starting streaming, which I think is totally valid, is that if you asked the leadership of the company, they would argue that this is more of a minor alteration because they still believe in streaming. They're just making some changes to it. But that is, of course, a little bit of corporate spin.
Joel Weber's here, the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine, and it's, you know, a really timely story considering the headlines we got earlier today about Netflix launching that service, and we got some details on how much it's going to cost, Joel.
Yeah, so Lucas, the thing that I just wanted to spend a little bit of time talking to you is this: the culture at Netflix. And you know, Saranda's obviously been there for a while, has been the architect of sort of the content strategy. The thing that, you know, like we say in the story, he never wanted to do was ads, right? And so internally, I'm really curious to see how they tested the price of this model. Like, what's your early sense of just like, how did they land on this particular price?
Well, I think the price comes from mimicking other services. They don't like to say that out externally. You know, there was a call earlier today where a reporter asked Greg Peters, the COO of the company, if they chose $6.99 a month because it's a dollar less than Disney Plus's ad tier, which is $7.99 a month. And they said no. But I've had conversations with people at the very top of the company who said that they were modeling it a little bit after Hulu, which was sort of the first big streaming service to offer ads, one of Netflix's earliest competitors. And it's priced in a way where they believe the $6.99 a month, $7 a month, plus what they'll make from advertising means that they'll make as much, if not more, from an ad to your customer as they will from the premium one. To your question about culture, I just think this year in general, the past couple of years have been very destructive towards a culture that was pretty unique in business.
Well, stick with that, because one of the things that you talk about was the, I would call it a debacle, which was the Quickster moment where they said, you know what, we're going to change the name and we're going to turn the streaming thing into Quickster. And, you know, it did not go over well. But it speaks to this company's ability to sort of try things. Maybe you soft launch something, it doesn't go well, and you pivot. And boy, that last decade since the Quickster thing looked really good. But one of the things you point out in the story is that there's not that many people left at the company from back then.
Yeah, I mean, you have to give them credit, to your point about Quickster, with the advertising and the password sharing. They're moving very quickly. I mean, they went from, at the end of last year, still not thinking they were doing advertising, to standing up an ad service in less than a year. They're doing it faster than Disney got their ad-supported tier out there. And keep in mind, Disney already has an ad-supported service in Hulu, and Disney is a major player in video advertising. So there is a degree to which the company can still move incredibly quickly, and I think that's a credit to Reed Hastings and Ted Sarandos. But a lot of the senior leadership around them has left. There's just, in general, a lot of restlessness among employees. And I think there was a feeling for a long time that, you know, Netflix was the place to work if you wanted to be in media, and in some cases in tech. I mean, it was at the top of like every list of most desirable company. And it's not like it's completely fallen off, but for a lot of the folks who work there, it now feels like another company, because there was forever this very unique culture that Reed Hastings had built and written a book about. And while it's still there in pieces, you know, it has kind of fallen to prey to the same thing that all companies do as they get scale. They just become more corporate and traditional.
So what has stuck around from that infamous culture deck that kind of went viral years ago? The idea, you know, the company is like a sports team, not a family, right? They'll cut people who aren't top performers, but at the same time, they encourage you to go out and see how much you're worth in the marketplace and come back and you can get a raise from Netflix that way. I mean, what parts are sticking around to you and what parts are kind of gone there?
I mean, I'd say it's a moderation of things, right? So the company is infamous for having radical transparency. You know, Reed Hastings modeled a lot of his leadership off of Ray Dalio, the Bridgewater guy. And that comes in a couple forms. It's a lot of feedback, so people being very direct and blunt with one another, and also then sharing metrics and data. You know, Netflix makes the pay available to employees can see what one another is making above a certain level. They share their financial results weeks before they announce them publicly with hundreds of employees, which is very rare. Some of that is still sticking around. They still share some of those financial results ahead of time. They do still have the pay available to some. But you talk to employees and they say that a lot of the decision making, which used to be decentralized, it used to be you wanted to empower people who were, you know, VP level, relatively mid-level executives to be able to buy a project or try something. That just doesn't happen as much anymore. A lot of the decisions seem to be made by a few stakeholders, and people are just playing with fear more because the company is under more pressure.
Hey, just got about 30 seconds left here. I love this line, though, in your story. With all this going on, you say it's important to note that in some ways Netflix has never been stronger. 20 seconds, why?
It's profitable. It doesn't have to borrow money anymore. And it is far and away bigger than all these other companies, which are dealing with the decline of cable TV, which does not affect Netflix.
Which, Lucas, thank you for this story. Perfectly timed. I mean, yeah. You think about all these other companies that are basically going through the growing pains that Netflix has gone through. Netflix built its dynasty on cheap debt, and they're profitable and know how to do this. It's like, you know, to some advantage, there's a serious advantage there.
Yeah, it's a great deep dive into so much when it comes to Netflix and the changes that it's making. It's like you knew something was going on, that there'd be some headlines here, Joel.
I mean, I get to work with people like Lucas. It's amazing.
He is amazing. Lucas Shaw is entertainment reporter at Bloomberg News from LA, and of course, the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek, Joel Weber, here in our studio. This is Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Businessweek with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
This past Monday, you all know this, and depending on where you were around the country, Columbus Day and or Indigenous Peoples Day. And on the latter, the World Health Organization has noted that the health of Indigenous peoples is often marked by higher rates of health risks, poorer health outcomes, and greater unmet needs in terms of health and social services.
We've got Dr. Donald Warren with us, co-director of the Center for Indian Health at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dr. Warren joining us on the phone from Baltimore this afternoon. Dr. Warren, how are you?
Doing very well. How are you doing?
We're doing well, thanks. Hey, give us an idea of the health challenges facing Indigenous people in this country. What are you focused on as at the Center for Indian Health at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, which I should note is supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, the founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies?
Yeah, so we've had the Center for American Indian Health for over 30 years, actually. And the original work took place in Arizona in collaboration with a couple of the tribes who were facing some infectious disease issues. And at that time, there were children, very young children, who were dying from dehydration. So the original work was actually to develop oral rehydration therapy that eventually became Pedialyte, actually. So little known fact that Pedialyte actually originated out of that work.
Interesting.
Through the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health in collaboration with tribes in Arizona. And since that time, over the last 30 or so years, they've expanded the work to well over 200 tribes across the U.S. and expanded beyond infectious disease to include things like maternal and child health, as well as addressing behavioral health considerations and chronic disease. So we just recently, within the last less than 1 month, changed the name from the Center for American Indian Health to the Center for Indigenous Health, and we'll be having more of an international focus moving forward.
Talk to us about Indigenous communities in the U.S., in the United States, or even globally. Why is it that they're having such a tough time in terms of access to good health care and having good health outcomes?
Well, each population is different, but there are some commonalities. And when we look at the Indigenous populations, those are the first inhabitants of various parts of the earth. And, of course, for the United States, that would include both American Indian and Alaska Native populations, as well as Native Hawaiian and other Indigenous peoples in the Pacific Islands that are in U.S. territory. So we have a very diverse group of Indigenous peoples in the United States. But specifically for American Indians and Alaskan Natives, what really makes us unique is that we have sovereign nations within the United States. So there's actually 574 federally recognized sovereign tribes. So we have our own elected officials, our own governments, in many cases our own health systems. But the big challenge is that we face terrible rates of poverty and marginalization in many of our tribes. So one of the things that we see across populations served by Indian Health Service is a lot of poverty-related illnesses and other socially determined health disparities. And unfortunately, the Indian Health Service is terribly underfunded. And if we look at just the funding for IHS compared to Medicare, for example, IHS is funded about $3,000 to $4,000 per patient per year. Medicare is funded at $12,000 per patient per year. So we just have a terribly underfunded health system coupled with an impoverished population, generally speaking.
Dr. Warren, can you talk a little bit about your bio? And you know, from what I've read, this, you know, medicine runs in your family. Can you talk a little bit about your background and how you bring a traditional approach to what you're doing today?
Absolutely. So I'm Oglala Lakota, originally from Kyle, South Dakota, on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. And I was very fortunate to grow up in a family with a lot of traditional healers and medicine men. So several uncles and I had a grandfather who were all traditional healers. And I've learned a lot about traditional Lakota approaches to health and wellness just from my own family. And it's also a ceremony family, so we have sacred ceremonies that we participate in every year and really hanging on to the beauty and the benefits of connectedness to traditional culture. In addition to that, my mom is a nurse. She's 83 and still working. I like to tease her that she failed retirement because she tried to retire. And she's still working as an educator and really helping to educate the next generation of American Indian nurses. So I've been exposed to the whole field of healthcare from traditional cultural perspectives as well as modern medical perspectives. And then I was very fortunate. I did well in school and was able to go to Stanford for medical school and Harvard for my Master of Public Health.
I've got to ask you, we've only got about a minute left, so this is not an easy thing I know to answer, but I mean, it feels like another population in the United States that gets an incredible raw deal, and indigenous people over and over again, you know, you can pick your point, is being left behind. What big program or policy change could we do that would make a difference on the population in the United States specifically, I'm asking? We've got about a minute.
Yeah, and in the U.S., one of the unique considerations is that most of our tribes also have treaties with the federal government. So there's a government-to-government relationship. And as part of those treaties, it's well documented in case law and in other examples that we have a legal treaty right to health services in the United States. So the only thing that we would ask is that the federal government live up to its treaty obligations, much in the same way we would criticize other nations for not living up to their treaty obligations. We should actually be looking at our treaty obligations to our indigenous peoples in the U.S. and recognize that underfunding the Indian Health Service really is a breach of those treaty obligations.
Very interesting and informative. Dr. Donald Warren, thank you so much. Really appreciate your time today. Co-director for the soon-to-be Center for Indigenous People at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, Center for Indigenous People's Health, I should say. And of course, Johns Hopkins is supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. Dr. Warren joining us on the phone from Baltimore. And we just want to mention, be sure to check out, too, we've got a podcast here at Bloomberg. Rachel Adams Heard, it's called In Trust, and they've been investigating a transfer of Native American wealth. And you can find that at Bloomberg.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
When cybercriminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, today, Bloomberg Live hosting a second day of Bloomberg Invest. It's an annual gathering of the leading names covering everything from crypto to credit markets and then everything in between. And it was in person for the first time since the pandemic and comes amid, as you know, an era of lots of market volatility and uncertainty. I caught up with an executive from the largest owner of commercial real estate globally, Kathleen McCarthy. She is the global co-head of Blackstone Real Estate, which has a $577 billion portfolio and about $320 billion, that is. Is in investor capital under management. Lots to talk about. We began, though, when I asked her how, against a tough market backdrop and daily mixed signals, how things are going.
It is an exciting and interesting time because, as you can see, there's different signals coming through. And I think we are better positioned than anyone to know what's really happening. We have $600 billion of real estate. We're in 37 different countries. A portfolio, though, that's highly concentrated into four key themes. 80% of our capital is in warehouses, rental housing, lab office, and hospitality investments. And what I'd say we're seeing is actually very strong fundamentals in those sectors. So when you talk about property performance, particularly for rental housing, that continues to be strong, partly because of the pressures on the for sale market with rising interest rates. Logistics demand, so warehouses. In the U.S. today, we are at record low vacancies, less than 3% vacancies in the markets we operate in, which are the densest, most urban kind of areas. And we're also seeing very strong rent growth. So in the U.S., in last month, rent growth in our markets was 30%. Wow. In Canada, it was even stronger, 50%. And so I think when we're thinking about the real estate market, we continue to see a lot of strength, notwithstanding there are pressures around us in terms of interest rates, an economy that the central governments are, of course, trying to cool, and persistent inflation. But we feel really well positioned for that. And I'd also highlight that I think this moment in real estate, this cycle, is quite different than others we've been
different,
in the
good,
past.
Different, good, different, bad.
That's a good different. I mean, good, different. When you think about what kind of led to real estate downturns in the past, there are really two primary factors. It was too much capital, generally in the form of debt, creating greater leverage, fueling new speculative development. And it was too many cranes, too much development. And really, when you think about what happened in the years following the financial crisis, and leading up into COVID, we really never saw those excesses come into our market. And so as we head into a period where there may be more economic headwinds, real estate actually is really well positioned from a fundamental standpoint.
Economic headwinds or recession?
It's very hard to call. And I'm not.
Why is it so hard?
I think, I think part of it is what we're seeing and some of the things that I think the central governments are trying to combat, which is just this continued strength. They see low unemployment, mm-hmm. strong rent growth, and that is part of what the big challenges ahead. So I don't know if we're going to have a recession. I'm not an economist, but I would say there's definitely economic cooling.
Are you guys having conversations internally, like thinking like, hey guys, we need to be thinking that maybe in this market,
yeah, what I would say is we've been planning for a long time, and this comes through in the portfolio we've constructed, for an environment that might have been like this in terms of higher interest rates, higher inflation. And so we really focused on trying it to be in those high cash flow growth mm-hmm. assets. And again, I'd say today we're still seeing those stronger than inflationary cash flows in our portfolio. But certainly we are always trying to position for environments that change. We've been doing this for 30 years. We've seen a lot of different environments. We thought we had seen it all. And then COVID hit and hotel revenues went to zero. I'm telling you, no one underwrote that before we had a pandemic.
Yeah.
But the great news is our portfolios are built really to try to withstand any kind of environment. And the higher than anticipated rent growth we've experienced, again, may kind of come down modestly, but we feel really well positioned for that.
And distress for you guys can be opportunity, big Definitely. Time. We saw that after the financial crisis in terms of housing.
I would say environments with distress, with volatility, with a pullback in capital markets activity, and we're seeing in particular much more constrained capital markets today, that tends to be a great environment for us and really for any investor who is well capitalized and who has real strengths to lean on. So we have a data advantage. Our portfolio gives us more information on what's really happening. That helps us build conviction around what we want to do next. And then I'd say the combination of deep experience from a large team and capital makes us well positioned to really support situations where others may be needing to sell assets, others might need liquidity, and we're able to then get in and buy high quality real estate.
All right, that was a conversation earlier at Bloomberg Live, their Bloomberg Invest event. Kathleen McCarthy, global co-head of Blackstone Real Estate, massive portfolio, as I mentioned, largest owner of commercial real estate. We covered a lot of ground. We could have talked for another 30, 40 minutes easily, but there's a lot more to that conversation. You can find it at BloombergLive.com and just search on Bloomberg Invest.
Well, I'm eager to see what they do in this environment. When they start seriously deploying more capital, when they see valuations come down enough to do that.
But they are really good at picking up distressed assets. They bought a lot of residential housing after the financial crisis. Oh, yeah. Casino in Vegas, the Cosmopolitan, picked up for a song. It was beaten up. And then they, sold it and made a really strong profit on it.
So what does this cycle look like?
opportunity she sees globally around the market. They really double down on warehousing and distribution. She thinks there's going to be more of it. And that was something that that was a play pre-pandemic and played off and paid off really well for them.
Yeah, think about the consumer shift.
Yeah, exactly. And then as you have more companies coming back and they're going to need, you know, distribution facilities, like we talk about nearshoring, onshoring.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kruszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
That all plays into it.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving you crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right. Speaking of going crazy, we're all a little bit crazy about today's market, trying to understand it. We keep getting lots of emails, and thank you, everybody, listeners in the Wall Street community and others who are saying, here's what we think is going on. So we're going to continue to track. And we've got another voice to tell us what he thinks about the trade, because we are definitely well off our lows and big swings in the equity averages today.
Big swings today. Dave Donabedian is Chief Investment Officer at CIBC Private Wealth Management. Dave joins us this afternoon on the phone from Baltimore. Dave, good to have you back with us. How are you?
Doing well. How are you?
We're doing pretty well. We're kind of scratching our heads here quite a bit thinking about today's equity trade. We had some great comments from Ira Jersey earlier giving us some insight into what's going on in the bond market. How do you look at things?
Well, you'd love to think this sharp turnaround was because everybody took a second look at the CPI report and said, gee, not as bad as we thought, but we know that's not the case. It's bad.
Funny.
And the timing of the move late morning, it was a rather sort of violent turnaround to the upside. And usually that suggests some kind of programmatic or algorithmic buying. So I think that's part of the story. We've down 6 days in a row. A lot of the sentiment indicators show we were sort of at extreme levels of bearishness. The bull bear ratio coming into the last couple of days is about as low as it ever gets. So it may have just been an oversold market.
Okay. I mean, I'll take that as as good an explanation as any.
You don't sound like you got conviction behind it, though, Dave. I mean, does it feel, it's funny. I just put out a Twitter poll and I'm asking everybody again, stock market bottoming.
Are you tweeting during the show?
I'm a multitasker. Okay. And the majority of responses say, no, it's not a bottom. Almost 53%, about 18% say yes. And about 30% say no idea. And I had hashtag volatility. So it is, what does a market bottoming look like? And can we say that the market bottoming that we are likely to see this time around is going to be same as what we've seen in the past? Because I do wonder how the pandemic and all the liquidity that was pumped into the markets kind of changes what it looks like.
Right. Yeah, I don't think a day like this signifies a market bottom. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we had a really strong market from mid-June to mid-August, and it was just a bear market rally. But I think we're certainly closer to the end than the beginning of this bull market, and we've really identified three things that need to fall into place to feel confident that a new bull market can begin. And we're just to sort of do a progress. The first one is we need to see clear evidence that inflation has peaked and is on a downward trajectory. safe to say we're not there yet. The second one is we need to see a downside surprise on expectations for the Fed funds rate. Now, that's kind of interesting after today because we're getting there. Our view has been that that Fed funds would need to go to 5% next year, which was way high on the consensus list. But that's about where the market is now. So we're making some progress there. The third one is I think there needs to be a more realistic outlook for corporate profits, right? The current estimate still calls for an 8% increase in corporate profits next year. That's kind of magical thinking to me, given the economic environment we're likely to see. So we actually, this sounds counterintuitive, but I think we actually need to see earnings estimates come down for us to feel that they're appropriately valued before we can really begin a new bull market. So we're a ways away from it, I think.
How much do earnings estimates have to come down, in your opinion?
Well, right now they're expected to be up about 8% versus this year, the 2023 numbers. I think we'll be really lucky to be flat in 2023 versus 2022, and more likely slightly negative. So, so they need to come down another, we'll call it 8 to 10% to say, gee, this is realistic.
It's interesting too that you were talking about downside expectation on the Fed funds rate, and I'm looking at the warp function on interest rate probability, world interest rate probability for the United States. And we were just talking to Ira Jersey, who thinks that pricing cuts that are being priced in right now by the markets, he thinks they're pricing it too early. In other words, that the Fed stops raising rates, he thinks it's going to be later rather than earlier. And he also says they're not pricing more cuts to come later on. Do you trust kind of market indicators right now at this point? Do you feel, here we have a 5% swing on the S&P and the NASDAQ today, and the Dow, excuse me, and yet the VIX comes down. I don't know how to explain that.
I can't explain it either. I think in terms of the path for Fed funds, again, our view has been they funds peak at 5%, probably in the second quarter next year. The warp function, as you mentioned, is saying that's about what the market now thinks. But I think that the missing piece may be that we go for a multi-month period where whatever the peak is, let's say it's 5%, it stays there. Mm-hmm. And the Fed watches. There's you talk to a lot of market participants, and there's an assumption that, well, the Fed's going to do their final rate hike at one meeting, and the next meeting they're going to start to lower rates. I don't think so.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to be stuck at that rate for most of the second half of 2023 as well.
What would you be buying in this environment?
Well, I think the equity market. Our advice generally has been to go slow in terms of putting money to work because, as I said, we don't quite think we're at the bottom of this bear market. We are focused mostly on dividend payers and those companies that are still going to be able to grow their dividends, through this difficult economic environment. Defense contractors, infrastructure stocks, healthcare are some of the areas. Small caps continue to be quite attractive on a valuation basis. Now, they're not going to be immune if we continue to be in a bear market environment, but they may be what leads us out when the bull market begins.
Go ahead, Carol.
No, go ahead, please.
So Dave, Carol asked what you'd be buying. I want to know, I know you tried to explain when you'd be buying here, but in terms of time frame, how long are we going to be sort of, searching for a low here and kind of just treading water in the S&P?
I think for a couple more months. Again, impossible to know exactly,
yeah.
Right? But I think we've got a couple more months of this sort of sloshing back and forth and probably with a little bit of a downward bias. But as negative as we may be on the economic forecast, we're actually pretty positive about equity prospects for 2023. We're likely to see a recession begin, probably sometime in the first half of 2023. But we know from long history that the stock market tends to bottom in the middle of the recession, sometimes even in the early stages of the recession, doesn't wait till the recession's over. So we do think things are falling in place for a better market for equity investors, but it may not be until next year.
If you had to make a choice, U.S. versus non-U.S., where would you go right now?
Short-term U.S., if you're a longer-term investor, non-U.S. You've got a truly inexpensive valuations. And so I think with, a 1 to 3 year view, non-U.S.
All right. Well, good to know, and certainly something to think about on a day where we're all trying to make sense of another volatile day with lots of swings. Dave Donabedian, thank you so much. He's Chief Investment Officer at CIBC Private Wealth Management, joining us on the phone from Baltimore.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.